again, you're listening to America's 12-Step Radio Show. My name is Drew, and this is Stepping Out. Talking to what's known as double winners. The double winners are people that have gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and also have spent time in Al-Anon to deal with some of the issues regarding their relationships. If you want to find out a little bit more about Al-Anon, you can visit them online at www.alanon.org, or also for AA, you can visit them at www.aa.org. And up next, we have John. Hello, John. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks.
Good, man. Thanks for coming down. Tell us a little bit about what it is to be a double winner.
Yeah, being a double winner is basically, for me, an acknowledgement that not only am I an alcoholic, but my life as both an active alcoholic and as a recovering alcoholic was affected by the alcoholism of other people.
Okay.
And I didn't figure that out till really late in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad I did. And, you know, the two are very intimately connected. But, you know, long before I started drinking, I had the symptoms of what I consider to be alcoholism. I certainly had the attitudes that I think of as alcoholic attitudes.
How old are we talking about?
Really from as young as I can remember.
Okay.
You know, I was, and just kind of by way of background, you know, my parents divorced when I was three. My father eventually went to live thousands of miles away. So I was an only child raised by a single mother, a single working mother. And, you know, this was back in the 60s. So, you know, this really had, you know, this had an effect on me in terms of feeling different than the other kids. You know, back then, divorce was not the norm. And sadly, it is now. But
sure.
Back then, it wasn't. And and so that in itself, you know, gave me a set of issues that a lot of the other kids didn't have. You know, that was just a contributing factor to the feelings that I had as a kid, you know, the feelings of just being anxious and different. And things really started to change for the worse when I hit the age of 12. And in my hometown, that was the age when you went from grade school to junior high. And what happened to me was, you know, in my last year of grade school, I was basically a normal skinny little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And when I showed up for junior high, all of a sudden, all the other kids had gone through a growth spurt. All the other boys had gone through a growth spurt, and I hadn't. And I found myself basically the smallest kid in my class, and I remained physically the smallest kid in my class for the next 5 years.
Mm.
And so I really felt different physically, and I couldn't participate in some of the things and feel a part of, like, you know, I was just too small for football, too short for basketball. I was a bad baseball player. In eighth grade, the wrestling team came to me and said, "Would you please wrestle the 78-pound weight class because you're the only kid in school who can qualify for that weight?"
Mm.
So I couldn't fit in. I couldn't feel like I fit in the regular ways. And what I quickly discovered at the age of 12 was that alcohol was an important part of socializing. The other kids wanted to have alcohol around. And as a, you know, crafty, cunning, devious, conniving little kid, I realized that, you know, while they were practicing football or studying or whatever they were doing, I could go out and find ways to get alcohol and thus find ways to kind of fit in with my peer group. And so that's what I did. I lived in a big college town. And so my weekends were spent as a young person, my weekends were spent outside of package stores,
mm-hmm.
basically, you know, with my allowance money, asking college kids to go in and buy quarts of Colt 45 for me
okay.
and my friends. So I spent junior high weekends behind shopping centers chugging, you know, and right away, alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It's just that simple. Alcohol made me feel all the things that I was incapable of feeling on my own. It made me feel comfortable in my own skin. It made me feel relaxed. It made me feel a part of the people that I was with. It made me feel funny. It made me feel bigger. It made me feel the things that I just couldn't feel without it. And it worked that way, and it worked for a long time that way. As the years progressed and as I, you know, went along with my life, all that really changed was the number of times a week that I got drunk. So by the time I got to high school, you know, I had a bowling class for a couple semesters in the morning, and we would chug quarts of Colt 45 before the bowling class and go in and bowl drunk. We would go to package stores at lunchtime and drink quarts in our cars. And, you know, life for me at that age was lived for the next party, you know, the next Friday afternoon club, the next weekend keg party, whatever it was that was next. That's what I focused on. And school was just what I had to get through to get to that party. You know, I didn't know why. I just thought that's kind of how everybody lived. I thought that's my job in life was to avoid pain, avoid feeling anything negative, and be ecstatic and euphoric as often as I possibly could. I thought that's what everybody did. That's all I knew, and so that's what I did. And you know, by the time I got to college, you know, I was making all of my decisions based on alcoholism.
Okay.
Basically, I chose the college that I went to because I knew it was a big drinking school, it was a big party school, but it was small enough that I wouldn't disappear. You know, I knew I had a chance of getting through college because it was small, and you know, at least maybe they would kind of keep me honest, which is what happened. You couldn't kind of disappear there. You kind of had to study a little bit, so I scraped by. But by the time I got out of college, all the controls on my drinking were gone. Basically, I could drink whenever I wanted to. I was an adult. I went into the business world and chose all of my friends based on the same thing. You know, who was the big drinker, who drank like I did, who wanted to go out at lunchtime and have a few drinks and, oh, by the way, not work anymore for that day, you know, go back to the office and kind of try to find ways of scraping by without really doing any work because it was just too difficult when you're drunk.
Did you try to surround yourself with people who drank more than you?
It was hard to do, but I did manage to do that occasionally, yes.
Okay.
And you know, along with that, my whole life was built on the concept of self-sufficiency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was going to take care of my problems. I knew what I was doing. Thank you very much. And basically, I figured as long as the outside looked okay, as long as you thought I had it together, then that was the name of the game, and everything must be okay. And so if I was around people that were doing what I was doing, and if I had a job and a roof over my head, then you know, there couldn't be a problem.
Right, right.
And what happened to me was, unfortunately, alcohol stopped working. You know, all the things that it did for me early on in my drinking career at the age of 12, by the end, it stopped doing that. And I realized, you know, looking back, I didn't know this at the time, but looking back, I realized that through all the time that I was drinking, through all those years of adolescence when my peers were, you know, taking chances and feeling ups and downs and having relationships, whatever they were doing, and learning from those experiences, I wasn't.
Right.
I was medicated. And I didn't grow emotionally. You know, I was just kind of in a holding pattern all those years. And I think what happened to me was that kind of caught up to me in the end. And I found myself in adult situations that I just wasn't emotionally capable of handling in a mature way.
So you had like the emotional skill set of a child then?
Exactly.
Okay.
And so as I tried to deal with those problems, you know, things were going bad, going wrong, and it was really difficult to deal with. You know, I eventually got myself into a business situation and a romantic situation that I just couldn't deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And my approach to dealing with anything was to drink. And the more I drank to try to distance myself from these situations, the less the drinking was working. And like somebody else was saying earlier this evening, I started to have panic attacks and anxiety attacks. You know, I think inside, you know, all the years of stuffing feelings, of not feeling things, you know, even though I experience something that's disappointing and I try not to feel it by drinking, you know, the disappointment is still there. It still lingers. And I think that stuff accumulates. And so by the time all this was happening in my life, the relationship, the job, I think the accumulation of all that unresolved stuff, it just started boiling out. You know, it just started spilling over the top. And no amount of alcohol could, you know, could help that, could keep it from spilling over.
Right.
So I had these panic and anxiety attacks. I had You know, I had what some of the AA literature talks about, unnamed fears. You know, I would wake up in the middle of the night in my bed sweating, thinking that there was somebody in the room about to kill me. You know, I started having physical effects. And that's what really concerned me, you know, because I was 27. How could I be having the physical effects of alcoholism?
Sure.
That was scary. You know, at the age of 27, I found myself with a swollen liver. I had lost the sensation in my toes.
Wow.
I was losing the sensation in my fingertips. I had no idea that that was a common symptom of late-stage alcoholism. I had no idea that alcoholism affected the central nervous system and the cardiovascular system as profoundly as it did in my case. I was having auditory hallucinations, and as I mentioned, I was having panic attacks, which I had no idea were also a very common characteristic of late-stage alcoholism. Didn't know any of that stuff. I really just thought I was losing my mind. You know, and my solution to every problem in my life was always to drink. And the more I drank, the more these problems were getting worse. And you know, it was terrifying. The solution, drinking, was no longer working. You know, I ended up going to a family gathering, not intending to drink. I hadn't seen my mother or some other people there in a long time. And the first night of this gathering, my cousins asked me to go out for a drink with them at a local bar. I said, yeah, sure, of course. And the next thing I know, it's 2 a.m. They're long gone. I'm there with the town drunk, you know, trading retaliatory shots back and forth.
Okay.
And then the next thing I know, I wake up on my bathroom floor. No idea how I got there. I'm covered in vomit. And, you know, I had this thought at that time, gee, you know, this isn't exactly how I wanted my life to be going.
Mm-hmm.
And if I keep drinking, this is just going to keep happening and it's only going to get worse. And that was the first time in my life that I ever connected alcohol to the downward trajectory of my life. That was the first time that I ever entertained the notion that maybe alcohol was not the solution, it was the problem.
Okay.
And so I decided that I wasn't going to drink anymore. And so for the next month, I didn't drink and I didn't go to a program or anything. I just didn't drink. It was not good.
Because you're saying you're having hallucinations and stuff. I mean, were you going through the whole DTs? And
I was in such bad physical shape. I don't know what I was going through.
Yeah.
You know, it was bad before and it was bad after. I did feel physically better during that month, you know, even though mentally, you know, and this kind of gets back to some other things. You know, if you asked me while I was drinking, are you an alcoholic? My response probably would have been, yeah, sure. You know, what's the difference? Yeah, great. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, that's kind of cool. Yeah, alcoholic. You know, because there was kind of a romance to that word to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had said, is your life unmanageable? I would have said, no, it's manageable. I have a roof over my head. I have a job. I have clothing. That's manageable. And what I never entertained until I made it into AA was that maybe the unmanageability they were talking about was internal unmanageability.
Right.
I always thought it meant external, you know, things. Emotionally, my life had always been unmanageable. You know, I was always confused. I was always, reeling from my own emotions. So, internally, my life was very unmanageable, particularly at the end. You know, panic attack is not exactly a symptom of manageability.
Sure.
And so, when I went through this month of dryness, I was very, very fortunate that my best friend and drinking buddy at the time was arrested for a DWI, and the courts mandated him to go to AA and to alcoholism counseling. And so during this month, he was sharing with me his experiences from that. And, you know, I was very curious. I was very interested. And he mentioned that his alcoholism counselor had quizzed him about his alcohol consumption. She said, you know, how many drinks do you typically drink in a week? And he thought about the number. He cut the number in half. He gave the number to her. And she said, oh, my, you have a problem with alcohol. Now, when he told me that, I kind of lit up because I always thought he was kind of a lightweight. So, you know, what did that say about me?
Right, right.
So at the end of that month, the same cousins came back to town. I went out with them on the town. They got drunk. They got kicked out of a bar. I didn't drink, but I came really close, and it worried me. And I realized I'm going to cave in. I'm going to collapse. I'm going to drink soon. So I called this friend up, and I said, what do you think? And he said, I think you should come to one of these AA meetings with me. You know, they've got literature. You know, you can check it out and get some ideas. And I assumed that I would be going to somewhere in the Bowery, that I would walk into a room, like a smoky room filled with old men in trench coats. I'd sneak in. I'd grab some pamphlets. I'd sneak out. No big deal.
Right.
So the meeting that he took me to was this enormous, in New York, it's the Soho Sunday meeting, and I walked into this basement, and it was 400 people, every age, every, you know, the whole rainbow of humanity was in this room. And the first person that spoke at the meeting was different gender, different age, different ethnicity, different socioeconomic background, different profession, nothing in common with me on the outside. And as she started sharing, the first thing she talked about was vomiting. And, you know, it's different for everybody. For me, I knew I was in the right place. You know, I knew, like, okay, this is my problem. This is where I'm supposed to be.
Right.
And up until that point, you know, I don't think I had heard of AA. And yet, when I think back to college, I know somewhere I had heard of it. Because in college, in my fraternity, my one job was to hold a fundraiser.
Okay.
And I had the bright idea in college. I thought, hey, you know, the format was, we're going to throw a party, we're going to charge a dollar at the door, we're going to donate the door to a charity.
Okay.
And I thought, hey, let's hold a function for that group, AA. and we'll call it Drink for Those Who Can't. And I actually had one of the fraternity pledges call the local intergroup. The intergroup said, thank you, but we don't accept outside contributions. So we did it for muscular dystrophy instead. So clearly I had some, you know, notion of AA. So when I got to AA, I knew I was in the right place. And, you know, I eventually got a sponsor and I started working the steps. And that was fantastic. You know, that was the first time in my life that I ever actually took a good look at myself.
Okay.
You know, and up until that point, I did not want to take a good look at myself. I think because on some level, I suspected that if I took a good look at myself, it would just confirm what I had always, you know, thought somewhere in the recesses of my brain, that I was unlovable, that I was broken, there was something wrong with me, something really bad. And so when I had to take a look at myself in sobriety, it was painful, you know. But the good news was that, yes, I had deficiencies and weaknesses and problems, but I also had some assets, you know, and I had a lot of hope. I had a lot of people around me who had what I wanted and who were doing well in life, and that was wonderful.
Well, how did Al-Anon come into play into your recovery as it is now, and how does that enhance your sobriety and your relationships?
Right. You know, it took me a long time in sobriety of doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Like how long?
In my relationship. Well, I was sober for about 13 years.
Okay.
Before I decided to try Al-Anon.
Now, you'd already been through the steps of AA. You had a sponsor. You did all the good stuff.
Been through the steps many times. I had been in therapy for 8.5 years. I had found, you know, several different spiritual practices that were very helpful to me.
What was the jumping off point for you, though?
And what happened to me was I got into a relationship with a woman who was an alcoholic, active alcoholic. And after being with this person for a while, and after that relationship failed, it occurred to me that it was part of a pattern, and that I had been recreating this same relationship over and over again in sobriety. And I had no idea, for 13 years, that I had basically been dating the same person over and over again for 13 years.
Wow.
And, you know, friends finally said to me, you know, you really should try Al-Anon. They'd been saying it all along, but I finally heard it. So that's what I did. I went to Al-Anon, and sure enough, you know, when I got to Al-Anon, I realized that not only was I an alcoholic, and not only did my alcoholism affect me, but the alcoholism of members of my family affected me and affected the way that I was approaching relationships.
Like how? Give me a for instance.
For instance, I think one of the things in my family that I felt responsible for was I felt responsible for the happiness of the people around me. And if I wasn't doing the right things, then they weren't going to be happy.
Uh-huh.
And so when I approached romantic relationships, I was in that same mode. You know, I was finding people that were having problems in life that had, you know, major deficiencies. And I was involved in the fantasy that if I could fix that person, they'd love me forever. If I could make them happy, they wouldn't leave me or betray me. You know, I had this very strange notion of what my role there was. And, you know, I needed to find somebody whose happiness was contingent upon me. Gotcha. And that's really unhealthy.
John, thanks so much for sharing with us. This is America's 12-Step Radio Show. My name is Drew, and this is Steppin' Out.